Empire Podcast this week, the man of a thousand faces and voices, Andy Serkis, drops by to talk about Black Panther, plus all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is regretting getting Siri onto last week's podcast and not asking her or him to say Liss.
Where's the handle? Where is it? I must find it. He needs the axe. Please help. I have run out of material. I have run this joke into the ground and it is all I have. I am so alone.
Hello pod, I'm Chris Stewart and welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you once again by Sky Cinema, the dedicated home for movie lovers. Later in the show, I will, as usual, be pointing out a couple of movies you can watch on Sky Cinema, just two from the 1,000+ films available on demand, including a brand new premiere every single day of the week. How exciting! Exciting stuff. You excited, Helen?
The trailer for How to Train Your Dragon 3 has just dropped.
Oh my god.
Whee!
This week I am joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, as you've just heard, is our geek queen, who can be found moonlighting from time to time on rival podcasts. You never see me doing this. Like the Story Geeks. It's Helen O'Hara.
You liar.
Well, I've never been in the Story Geeks.
Okay, true, but, you know, only because you haven't organised it.
Mm-hmm. What podcasts are floating your boat at the moment, Helen? What's exciting you?
Well, I had a really good time talking to them. They were great fun. Hello, Jay and Daryl. That was great.
Yep.
And obviously the Cine Mile. We've both been on that one. Chris.
Yep.
You have been on it more than once.
I will do anything.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, you're a tart because maybe they paid you. I don't know. They didn't pay me.
They paid me in kindness.
Oh.
I paid them in wisdom, and they paid me. In kind.
I didn't.
They gave me nothing.
I didn't know you had any wisdom to pay with.
Nor did I.
Oh.
Who knew? I was ransacking my trousers and I found some wisdom. That sounds rude. Didn't mean it to. Anyway, what other podcasts have you been listening to?
That's about all. I mean, obviously the West Wing Weekly, which I've been listening to for a while, but I'm still way behind on. And the Thrilling Adventure Hour, which I just listened to old episodes of because I've heard them all now.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff. I thought, you know, it's never too late to change. And
true.
I thought, you know, last week we had a little bit of a nice chat about the TV shows we were watching. And I thought every week when I introduce you guys, maybe we should have a little chat about what we're reading or what we're listening to or what we're watching. You know, just shake things up.
Wow. Well, you should ask Johnny what he's reading.
Well, hang on a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not introduced yet.
He's not introduced.
Spoiler. That's,
yeah, exactly.
Ruined it. Ruined it. Get out.
No.
Okay. If you had been like, hey, Johnny, do you want to do a podcast of just the two of us for the next hour?
Absolutely.
Next up is a man who, like me, is a massive fan of the boys from Athens, Georgia, REM. It's Johnny Pyle. How are you, Johnny?
I'm very well, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, good, good. You listening to any podcasts, anything floating your boat at the moment? What are you excited about?
You know
what,
there is.
What is it, Johnny?
I'm binge listening, and then I've actually just got to the end of the most recent episode, so now I have nothing to listen to.
Uh-huh.
It's called... Oh, my God, hang on. It's called Are You Talking REM Re-Me.
That's a very exciting... Hang on a second. Wait a second. Is this an episode of Are You Talking REM Re-Me? Re-Me?
I think it might be.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Are You Talking? Are You Talking? REM, Re-Me, Re-Me. I'm Chris.
And I'm Johnny.
And we're talking about Are You Talking? REM, Re-Me, which is a fantastic podcast for REM fans. But what sets it apart from all the other, because there are thousands, literally thousands.
I mean, well, it's incredibly funny. It's Adam Scott, who you will know from...
Helen knows who he is.
Yeah.
Do you know him?
Yeah.
He's in Step Brothers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's
the first
he's only known from Step Brothers.
I mean,
no one knows him in anything else. I don't know him in that or Big Little Lies or nothing.
No,
Step Brothers is where people know him from.
Sure.
Yeah. What else? Parks and Rec.
He's Mr. Nope in Parks and Rec.
He is Mr. Nope.
Yeah.
Did he take her name? Is that how it works?
No.
Oh, okay.
But it should be.
He would have done because
he's
progressive.
He's that woke.
He's a woke Nope.
Sure.
Ben
yes.
Wyatt, woke Nope. What else?
So yes, it's him and it's Scott Ackerman, and they. Well, Adam Scott is the big REM fan, and they go album by album, track by track, episode by episode, talking about REM.
That sounds cool.
It is cool because actually they are very, very funny together.
Yeah. Yes,
they know,
that I believe.
They know a lot. And even if you like, you're not quite up on the albums, I think that there is certainly interest in, you know, what they think about it. Their jokes are certainly very, very funny. And they did a U2 one before, which, and I don't really have any much interest in U2, yeah, but actually I'm going to go back and listen to that.
It's called You Talking U2 to Me. And I didn't listen to it. And then they did an REM one, and I was like, yeah, I love REM, so I'm going to listen to that. And then I went back and started listening to some of the U2 one. The U2 one culminated in them interviewing U2 for over an hour. And
it's an
adorable episode because they're both really, really nervous.
Right.
Aww.
Scott Aukerman's interviewed loads of people in his career, but he's still really, really nervous. And Adam Scott's never interviewed anyone. And you could feel it. And they keep interrupting the podcast to go, okay, the question we're about to ask now is really dumb and we really regret asking it. And you can hear the nerves in their voice. And it's
maybe
just,
we should start doing that because
we would never stop. But it's really fun. So, you know, even if you don't like REM, it's
what
sort
is
of
wrong
podcast.
With you?
What is wrong with you? A varied, incredibly eclectic career.
My wife hates REM, but actually last night I persuaded her to go track by track on Murmur with me, and we went track by track as though it's the podcast, and I like tried to persuade her that each song was amazing.
Wow, you should totally do that. It wouldn't probably get the same traction as an Adam Scott led podcast, but you should absolutely do
it. I mean,
that.
Almost certainly not, but I mean, there's not a lot of like variation in this podcast. I'm just like, this song's amazing, and she's like, really does nothing for me.
I have so many questions about this, and yet I don't want the answers.
Go on, tell me.
No,
we are nude. What else?
You got to be nude for a podcast. That's, a nudecast is what I call it.
You've been trying to persuade me of this for years, Chris, and I think you need to give it up as a lost cause.
I just think it helps everyone be a little bit more free. A bit more free with their opinions, a bit more free with their knowledge, a bit more free with their laughter. It's just something I'm throwing out there. I'm experimenting. Yeah.
I'm
going to
do it now.
Yeah, Johnny's going to do it. Johnny's.
I don't care that we're in a glass pod booth.
We are actually in a glass pod booth. Please don't throw it out there. Is just what I'm saying.
Okay. No throwing anything.
Throwing of it.
I'm just going to let it dangle loosely.
Oh no, this has gone bad. This has gone bad. But yeah, anyway, so yes, REM are great. And that podcast, Are You Talking REM, Read Me, is also great. And I think that's wrapped up this episode of Are You Talking REM, Read Me.
Great.
Bye.
Bye. Good ep.
Great ep.
Now do we get to rejoin the Empire podcast?
Now we can talk about films. Wait a minute. Is this an episode of I Love Films? No, I'm kidding, of course. And if you listen to that podcast, you will get that we were standing on the shoulders of giants. Wait a second. Is this an episode of Standing on the Shoulders? Anyway, welcome to the Empire podcast. How are you both? You all good?
Yes, I am.
Took you by surprise with that, didn't
you? Did. What?
I've never.
You want to know how I am?
I've never inquired about your well-being in 6 years.
Never.
You all right, Helen?
6 years? How long do you think we've known each other?
It feels like 6 years. It's probably longer. Is it longer?
It's 14 and change.
See, that's because time travels differently for me.
Right.
You know, every day spent with you to me feels like a minute because it just goes by so quickly. Because it's a joy.
Thank
it's
you.
It's an unalloyed joy.
I don't understand why he's being nice and I don't trust it.
There's something coming.
Johnny, help.
Hang on. Let's just check under the table. No, his trousers are still on. I don't know what it is.
Everything is in place. Everything is exactly how it should be. No, I'm just glad that you're okay. I'm just glad that you're both okay. And thank you for coming to the podcast, which is something I should start saying every week. Thank you for coming to the podcast. Should we take a question? Should we take a question from a reader?
Yes, please.
Not a reader. What do you call them?
Listener,
that's it. Thank you. Okay, so this is a very serious question. This is from @BrazenFamp via Twitter, and she asks, given that Kelly Marie Tran has had to delete her social media due to the harassment she's taken, and that Solo has been boycotted by giant babies, how do you think fanatical fan bases affect movie and TV production? Is there people power in a negative aspect, and how can we subvert this growing trend? Okay, so this is we've had several questions like this week. Brazen Famp is the one that I my eyes happened to a light on. And we should probably put this in some context.
Yeah.
So Kelly Marie Tran plays Rose in The Last Jedi, and for the last few months has been a very, very upbeat, very positive presence on social media, but she has been the target of some vitriolic harassment from people who purport to call themselves Star Wars fans. And this week, her social media account just disappeared, along with all her posts. Now, maybe she's just taking a break, and maybe she's going to come back. There's certainly a lovely campaign out there to get her back, to show her that, you know, she is loved and held in high esteem by, yep, by Star Wars fans. Or maybe she generally has just had too much of people dissing her. Helen, what do you think about this?
I think let's proceed on the assumption that it is as reported, to do with the harassment, obviously with the caveat that we don't know the full fact yet. If that is the case, I think it's appalling, and I think these people should be ashamed of themselves, mm-hmm, obviously. And I think it's been a pattern now for a while, that it's the people of colour and the women who take the brunt of these campaigns, not the men. Not the white men, and it's quite noxious, and it's quite obvious actually if you look at it who they're targeting and how they're targeting them, and that makes it very, very unpleasant. And I feel like people talk about the internet like it's the Wild West, and maybe, mm-hmm, it was 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago. It's not anymore. It's where we all live a lot of the time, mm-hmm, and it's not okay to act like nothing there matters. It's actually not virtual. The internet is real, and it has a tangible effect on people's lives.
It's extraordinary to me that people can still say that they still think they can get away with saying things online that, yeah, they would in a
never
million
say
years
person.
Dream of going up to your face and, yeah, saying, or even in earshot. It's kind of extraordinary to me.
Well, that's it, and I think that's the big thing that everybody should kind of start taking, I don't know, take away from this, but like start remembering, I think, in our interactions with each other. I made a decision about nearly 10 years ago now to try and be a positive presence on you know, Twitter and the rest.
Yeah.
That's not to say that I don't publish posts bemoaning political decisions that are terrible, yeah, or, you know, complaining about Brexit, but and I'm absolutely going to continue doing that. But in terms of talking about people, talking about myself even, I try not to be completely negative the whole time, because it is real and it does matter, and it's just not how I want to be seen, and it's not how I want to act in the world. So,
yeah.
Why don't we all just try and act like we, you know, like we'd like others to be towards us? I just don't understand how people can seriously think it doesn't matter anymore. And people are not actually insulated by fame or money or anything else. It's not that she probably, mm-hmm, was paid a vast amount for that film,
I doubt it.
As a young star coming up.
Yep.
She doesn't have, you know, layers of protection. She doesn't have layers of bodyguards. She, you know, is a human being, and she deserves to be treated with some respect and some kindness.
It can be a really discomforting thing to have someone suddenly show up in your DMs or in your mentions, and, you know, I guess we get it on a very, very small scale.
Yeah, very, yeah, minor thing.
Compared to the likes of Kelly Marie Tran and Daisy Ridley, of course, who also, yeah, had to delete her social media account a few years ago.
This is the problem. Trolls don't have anything useful to say. Yeah. This is what it comes down to. They don't have anything coherent to say. They are pathetic. It is a terrible way to spend your life. And even if you're that angry about this, and even if you want to express yourself somehow, there is a better way for you to do that. Go away and write your own sci-fi script that would be better. Go and write some fan fiction Star Wars that actually expresses the sequels you'd like to see. There are better ways to do it than to harass people who have nothing to do with the decisions that have angered you in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that goes for us as well. I mean, people, you know, we've had people in our office get death threats for giving something a 3-star review, which is a recommendation.
I got my first death threat for giving Scooby-Doo 2 stars. Back in Scooby-Doo, the James Gunn,
wow,
written, Roger Gosnell directed adaptation of the beloved Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Yeah.
And I got a death threat for giving that 2 stars back in 2002. And I never know who wrote it, but the letter went, "You are red! You're going to lie!" So I don't know. I don't know who that was. I can't crack that code. But no, genuinely, I did get it. You know, at the time, you kind of go, "Oh wow, I've just been sent a death threat. This is fun." But for the most part, yeah, it's kind of weird. It's kind of freakish. And you should try and put yourself in the shoes of someone who gets that 1,000-fold.
Yes.
Every single day.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of the stuff that was said to Kelly Marie Tran, and it's absolutely vile and disgusting. And I think honestly, I think that this week has seen something of a line being drawn in the sand. It feels to me like this week's been a bit of a turning point. Not just because I've seen a whole lot of people, involved with Star Wars, some who aren't, going, okay, we're fed up with this. Because you guys are giving Star Wars fandom and fandom in general a bad name. And just stop it. We don't need this sort of toxicity anymore. Does that feel like that to you? Does it feel like this is a bit of a turning point?
I mean, honestly, probably not. I can imagine that we think, we've really turned a corner here, and then suddenly it happens again several months down the line when everyone's distracted by something else. Something else probably horrible has happened, like Brexit is going through, and suddenly, you know, someone else comes off and the whole cycle begins again. Yeah. Mm. But, I mean, look, we live in hope, right?
Yeah.
We do, and it's not, you know, obviously this is not just a film thing. This is happening all over. It's happening in music. It's very much happening in politics. Samantha Bee just went through it. Mm-hmm. I feel like if you suspect you're part of a mob, you should probably just take a moment, right, and breathe and maybe step back. Like, you know, for whatever cause, football, it's, you know, there have been cases of it in football very recently.
Well, football, Gary Lineker tweets something and he wants pooed on the pitch in Italia 90. So he'll say something about anything and then it'll be shat on, whatever he's talking about. And once, like when his dad died, the first tweets that he got back for him announcing that was shat on dad.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at what point is that a good idea? Is that, what point is that funny? At what point is that, like, not beyond, like, the realms of good taste?
Yeah. Because people don't think, and because people lack empathy. And there's an extraordinary lack of empathy going around right these days. And because it's so easy on Twitter, it's so easy just to go, and you can interact with your favourite stars, and sometimes they'll notice you, and sometimes they won't. Sometimes they reply, sometimes they won't. And it's so easy for people just to go on and type at Helen L. O'Hara and go,
thanks for putting in my hashtag in this discussion.
it's your handle.
I'm sorry.
But it's so easy to do that.
Pop.
And without a moment's thought. And to get caught up in that mob mentality. And I would hope that, and certainly I think Twitter and other social media platforms need to do a lot more in terms of their ability to report people.
Amen.
Their ability to block people and then just immediately stop those people from opening new accounts.
Yeah.
Just to go back to the Kelly Marie Tran situation and Brazen Fam's question, how do you think fanatical fan bases affect movies and TV production?
I don't think they do.
I hope they don't.
I mean, look, I think that they get talked about a little bit, but I think what filmmakers have found is that trying to do fan service and trying to cater to the very small vocal minorities historically has not worked terribly well. What has worked is having somebody with a vision, with a clear grasp of the story they're trying to tell and giving them the reins to tell it. If the Star Wars fans were right about the small vocal minority, I mean, about SJWs and Kathleen Kennedy and everything else, then Solo would have been a huge hit and The Last Jedi would have been a relative flop. And the fact is that's not the case. So what we're looking at here is the fact that they are just not correct. They are just not correct. Wonder Woman would have flopped if they were correct, and it did not. I think they're trying to hold back the tide. I think they're canuting the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think... Look, if you've always been in a privileged position and you've always seen yourself reflected over and over again on screen and you suddenly see other people up there as well, not replacing you, but just alongside you in any numbers, and that threatens you... Maybe just think for a moment about how it's been for literally everyone who wasn't a straight white male forever. It's so not about you. And sharing a little bit of attention does not mean that you were victimized. And I just... Look, I think all our listeners know this because I feel like if they didn't, they wouldn't be listening to us.
But I agree with you. I think, by and large, cross fingers, they're a good bunch. But also, I think... Fundamentally, the people who've been going after Kelly Marie Tran, the people who went after Daisy Ridley, the people who've been harassing Rian Johnson on a daily basis since before The Last Jedi came out, but certainly since The Last Jedi came out, the shit that guy's had to wade through on a daily basis. And he comes up smiling, and he's really fun and engaged with the fans who get it. But I think fundamentally what these people are misunderstanding is Star Wars. and they're misunderstanding Star Trek. When I see people, because I've seen tweets about Star Trek, people furious about the fact that there was a African-American lead, female African-American lead on Star Trek Discovery, yeah. And these people were absolutely furious. And it's like, have you seen an episode of Star Trek? Do you get that this show is about togetherness and inclusion?
There is no argument that Star Trek has not always been about tolerance, inclusion, diversity, and working together for a better future. There is no argument you can possibly make to say that ain't so. It's madness.
And Star Wars is also about idealism, mm-hmm. and it's about love, and it's about family.
It is about, if you will, social justice. Chris,
people, you could argue that.
Fighting for social justice. You might almost call
them... A warrior,
them.
Perhaps.
That's right. Oh, my God.
What's going on there? Anyway, we probably talked enough about them, but I would hope that Hollywood's not listening to this very, very small minority of people, because I think, honestly, the worst thing that a creative person can do in Hollywood is second-guess themselves and listen to people whose ideas are terrible.
I mean, look, if they'd listened to those people... The X-Men would have been wearing yellow and blue from the start, and we'd all still be pointing and laughing. Come on.
Yes, we would. Yes, we would. And we hope that Kelly Marie Tran, whose account is still active, she just has deleted everything, does come back to social media. If you want to get in touch on the Empire Podcast, but please be nice, you can do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. Otherwise, we won't see it. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. All right, time now to discuss this week's movie news. And there was a ton of it. There was a ton of movie news. Basically, every trailer in the world seemed to debut this week.
Every trailer in the world. Can we take a moment and watch... How to Train Your Dragon.
Helen.
Come on, please.
We're going to pause the podcast. Helen's going to watch...
No, we can all...
No one wants to watch it.
What?
You can watch it. We'll sit
Get
here.
Get out. Sorry.
So that was the... what's it called? How to Train Your Dragon 3, but it's actually got a title, hasn't it?
Hidden World.
Thoughts?
I'm bracing myself for heartbreak. And also for Hiccup's beard, which is very cappy. So I'm in favour. I think I've said before in the podcast, but I'm seeing a kind of E.T. phone home, E.T. goes home kind of vibe here, and I'm worried because I'm not sure I'll be able to cope. So I'm just going to start hydrating now so that when I cry my eyes out in the cinema, like, I'll still be left not a bitter husk of a woman.
Okay. Assuming there's someone who hasn't seen either of the other two.
Someone would be wrong. Just fundamentally, but yes, go ahead.
For not having seen them?
Yeah.
For thinking maybe they'll get around to them, but not having seen them yet?
Yeah, that's super wrong.
What if you'd seen the first movie and thought it was rubbish and therefore didn't watch the second movie?
Again, wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it still about How to Train a Dragon?
No, there's been very little training, I'll be honest, throughout the series. As a percentage of the screen
time. It doesn't even make sense for the first film.
There is training in the first film, although it's as much for the Vikings as the dragons. The second one had a bit of, you know, dragon innovation, but I wouldn't really call it training, so...
So what, are we building up to the training? What's going on here?
No, it's just more about the relationship between, you know, a boy and his dragon. And we've all been there, haven't we? You know, Hiccup and Toothless. But Toothless is honestly...
Which is which?
Toothless is the dragon.
Right.
He's honestly one of the great characters of the noughties. Like, he is genuinely one of the best, certainly the best animation characters I've ever seen, but also one of the best characters.
The dragon is?
Yeah, full stop. Yeah, he's phenomenal. Just a beautiful, beautifully animated beast. He's wonderful.
Okay.
There you go. Fully on board then with How to Train Your Dragon Hidden World. That is just one of the 27 different trailers that came out this week. And I know this is a podcast, but we will discuss the trailers as best we can. Why don't you watch along with them at home? After we did two spoiler specials for the for the Avengers Infinity War trailers. Loads of trailers out this week. Let's start a whole bunch of horror ones. So we're recording this before the first trailer for Halloween, the David Gordon Green, Danny McBride reboot sequel, whatever it is, to obviously John Carpenter's Halloween. That's going to be out today when you're listening to this. And also Corin Hardy's The Nun, we're going to get our first look at that, which is very exciting. But one horror film that did debut its preview this week was Luca Guadagnino's Suspiria. And this is his 2.5-hour long remake of the Dario Argento giallo classic. And did you see it? What did you think of that?
Dakota Johnson. I didn't see it, but I hear it looks great.
Well, it's very eerie. I thought it looks interesting. One of the things about the Dario Argento movie is that it's really colourful and really bright and psychedelic and batshit insane. And this one seems to be a little bit more muted in colour, but it seems to have an intense feelings. It's got Dakota Johnson's in there, Tilda Swinton's in there, lots of eerie goings on. Coven of Witches are in play. Oh, it's all very ooh. So fingers crossed for that one.
Yeah, I really like Dakota Johnson. I want her to have a really good role that's not 50 Shades of Grey, basically.
Not Anastasia Steele.
Yes, basically.
Yeah.
I think she deserves better.
I agree. And I think, I mean, you know, this has a hell of a kind of prestigious lineage, if you will. So it's looking pretty sweet.
Yeah. And obviously a bit of a left turn for Luca Guadagnino.
Very much so. Yeah.
But
which is always exciting, actually.
Yeah. Hey, he's a man who knows his films.
Speaking of left turns for you know, highly awarded directors, The Widows trailer came out this week as well.
Yes.
And this is Steve McQueen, the, you know, not just art house director, but like literally art director of, you know, well, in the sense that he was an artist who made videos.
Ah, know. He was an artist
video
director.
Video artist? I don't know what the word is. Anyway.
Fartist, I believe.
No, I don't think that's it.
I think that's it.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Steve McQueen, massive fartist.
I apologize at this point to, I mean, everyone, really. But of course, he made Shame, he made Hunger, he made 12 Years a Slave, he won the Academy Award for that, for Best Picture. And now he's making a thriller based on a 1980s Linda LaPlante ITV show.
It's like a heist movie, right?
It's a heist movie, yeah. Set in Chicago, Liam Neeson and his gang are about to do a big job.
Yeah.
And all die horribly. So they're widows. I mean, it's literally, it should be the opening scene if it's anything like the TV show.
That's a spoiler. I still think that's a spoiler.
I mean, it's called Widows.
Yeah, it's a spoiler. How
whose widow did
that?
You think they were?
I don't know. I actually was hearing windows when you said it.
Yeah. So anyway, they're widows, decide to do the job to get themselves out of a rather sticky situation.
Yes. And then they do the job as well.
Yeah.
That's another spoiler beyond that.
they decide to do the job. I didn't say they did it. Like,
I think that decision is a spoiler. I don't think we should have found that out.
So anyway, it's an incredible cast. Viola Davis, Elizabeth Debicki, Michelle Rodriguez, and Cynthia Erivo are the four widows, are the four main women. Because actually, technically,
spoiler,
one of them
now
is
we know their husbands die.
Well, actually, one of them, her husband isn't one of the dead men. There's another woman who doesn't join the gang. It's a whole thing. Anyway.
And what was at the end?
I'm definitely not telling you that. Anyway, but also you've got Colin Farrell, you've got Robert Duvall. It's just a phenomenal lineup, and I'm really, really hyped for it. Not least because I was on set, but also that.
Oh, now we see. Now we see. Now the penny drops. There you go.
It's also a script by Gillian Flynn, who, of course, did Gone Girl. So it's just just down the cast list. Just everybody involved seems to be amazing.
Is a Linda LaPlante miniseries? Is it a miniseries?
It was a six episode, yeah.
Is that highly thought of as far as those things go?
It was, yeah. Apparently it was the first sort of drama series to outnumber viewership for, what's the word? I don't know. Have a higher viewership than, like, the soaps. Like, it was,
oh, really?
It was absolutely essential viewing back in 1980, like,
three.
Two or something. Three.
I don't remember it.
No. What age were you at that point?
I was one.
Right. It's funny that you don't remember it.
Yeah, but, like, repeats and stuff, right?
I don't know, maybe not.
Like, I've heard of Prime Suspect.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a good bit later, though.
Okay.
Yep. So, very exciting, then, news about Steve McQueen and Widows. There's loads more trailers out this week as well. There was a trailer for The Lego Movie 2, which
looks
funny.
Really
looks
funny.
Good.
Really, yeah. Very happy.
The two trailers, there's three more trailers to talk about in fair amount of detail. Sorry, guys. One, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Love it.
I think this looks great.
Yeah, really excited. I'm excited to see Miles Morales. And I feel like this is a kind of soft launch so that in 5-6 years when Tom Holland, not that one, the other one, not the other one, the other one?
Hang on. You mean the noted historian, Tom Holland?
No, the other one.
Oh, right, the director of Fright Night and Child's Play. Oh, the guy who fixed James's roof.
No, the other one.
Oh, the guy who plays Spider-Man.
There you go. So yeah, I feel like when he moves on,
that would make sense.
What they can do is maybe replace him with Miles Morales instead of another Peter Parker, which would work wonderfully. And this sort of sets up, you know, I'm not saying everyone who would ever go see a live action Spider-Man is going to see this, but it sets up the character, gives people a little bit more familiarity with him, and kind of lays the groundwork a little bit for seeing him in live action in the future, which is super exciting.
So what this is a trailer, it's an animated Spider-Man movie that is written by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who were the guys who, of course, were working on Solo for so long, and did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego Movie and 21 and 22 Jump Street, and they produced it as well. And it is it's an alternate what if story set in a different universe in which Peter Parker is now an older guy, he looks to be in his 30s or 40s, and a new Spider-Man, Miles Morales, comes to the fore, and then there's loads of other Spider-Man characters like Spider-Gwen, and that looked like the Green Goblin was in there at one point as well. Liev Schreiber was this week revealed to be playing the Kingpin. Hailee Steinfeld is going to be playing Spider-Gwen. So it's a really good cast.
Yeah.
But the thing I think that sets us apart is the look of the thing. It looks incredible.
It looks gorgeous.
It's not like any animated film we've seen. It's very much influenced by comic book styles. You have Batman style-y, the words will come up on screen as things smash into each other, but it plays with different visual styles and different animation styles, sometimes within the same scene. Mm. I think it looks really dynamic, really refreshing, and I am there for it.
I'm super hyped.
Yeah, me too. Can't wait.
Good stuff. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and not part of the MCU, as far as we're aware. Then there's the Star is Born trailer. Now, this is the 47th remake of A Star is Born. This one is interesting because if you don't know what Star is Born is, Helen, you can fill people in quickly.
A young person at the very beginning of their career in an area strikes up a relationship with an older person who is an already established star in that area. Their love affair does not go smoothly.
There we go. So it's been remade loads and loads through the years. And this remake is directed by Bradley Cooper, who stars in the film as well, alongside Lady Gaga. Now, what did we think of this trailer? What did we think of it? The take in this one is that Bradley Cooper is a grizzled old country superstar who stumbles upon Lady Gaga, and she impresses him with the width of her pipes, and what?
It just sounds weird.
Does it?
I've had a man in fixing a boiler this week. Not a euphemism. Not a euphemism. An actual boiler.
Okay.
So
sure.
I'm now sensitive to pipe talk.
Well, aren't we all? Aren't we all? Get them checked, people. Get them checked. So she impresses him, and then she possibly eclipses him on the way down. And of course, he's deeply troubled because he's got a beard and a guitar.
He's got a great beard, though. Like, he shouldn't be worried about that beard.
It's a good beard.
It is a good beard. Like, it's one of the top 10 beards of 2018 so far. Obviously, alongside both of yourselves.
Right, so it's me, Bradley, and Chris.
This isn't a beard, what I have.
Of course it is.
I was being kind.
What I have can never be called a beard. I gave up on the whole beard thing about 2 weeks ago. I just thought, this is not happening. It's just not happening. Whenever Nick decided to grow a beard from scratch and did it in about a week... I did in a week what I've been trying to do for a year. I just went, no, I'm done. This is just.
But you haven't shaved.
Facial hair. No, I have shaved. I've shaved the bits, and I'll shave these little bits as well. And, you know.
Okay.
I haven't gone for the full. I guess there was protuberances previously, and now it's kind of not. It's more trim than it was before.
So anyway, A Star is Born. I really like the look of this. My interest went from zero to, you know, a solid, like, 8 probably on the strength of this trailer. I quite like the music. I find the tunes going around in my head a little bit afterwards. And yeah, it just looks quite cool. It's interesting. I mean, this has been in development for about ever. Like, Clint Eastwood was going to do it with Beyonce at one point.
And Bradley Cooper was attached definitely as a star when Clint Eastwood was going to direct.
Yeah.
And I think he liked it so much he took it over, when Clint went off to do something
else. It's been a while, But the reason it's been remade so many times is that sort of the dynamic and the drama of it kind of works. And I hope it does this time as well. I thought this looked good. I'm excited.
I am less up in it than you were. but it certainly looks interesting. And it's kind of mad when it comes up at the beginning and it goes, I'm not sure if it does say four-time Academy Award nominee Bradley Cooper, but it is mad to think that Bradley Cooper from The Hangover has been nominated for four Academy
Awards.
Bradley
Cooper will always be Sydney's best friend in Alias, let's be honest.
Of course, but he's a very good actor, Bradley Cooper, and sometimes it's easy to forget that despite all the huge nominations, and I expect this one might well get him number five.
He's fluent in French.
He's done interviews in French, yeah.
Which I think is remarkable.
When he came into the office,
I mean, lots of people speak two languages, but sure. For some reason I think that Bradley Cooper doing interviews in French is remarkable.
It is pretty cool. When he came into the office to do a web chat, we have never been more popular with the women's mags upstairs. Like, yeah. Suddenly they all wanted to be our friend, and they have never wanted to be our friends before, so...
So we just say there have been three major versions of this movie. It's been remade countless times, and the basic story has been remade countless times. But 1937, so the couple in that were Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. 1954?
Judy Garland.
Judy Garland and?
Oh, James Mason.
James Mason. 1976?
Chris Christopherson.
Christopherson.
Barbara Streisand?
Absolutely. And now this one, we have Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
And what do we think of Lady Gaga in this trailer?
I thought she was good. I mean, we know she has pipes. We know she can sing. But I thought, you know, it looked on this very limited evidence like she can act as well. Now, she didn't get massively great reviews for her role in American Horror Story Hotel, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But this is a bit more promising, so... Yeah, I'm optimistic, let's say.
What's interesting to me is that Lady Gaga is someone who, through her career, has hid behind artifice and you know, this grand representation of herself.
Meat dresses and
all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And in this one, she's very much unadorned, isn't she? It's very much, and I'd be intrigued to see whether there's a really great character there, because we obviously know she's got singing pipes. So the last trailer to discuss is the Girl in the Spider's Web trailer, which went up just before we started recording this podcast. And that has Claire Foy playing Lisbeth Salander. They've missed out. So this isn't the David Fincher. The David Fincher Girl in the Dragon Tattoo came out a few years ago. Did okay at the box office. That was Daniel Craig and Rooney Mara. Did okay at the box office, but not well enough to get a sequel. So they've decided to skip the next two books in the series written by Stieg Larsson and go straight to the one that wasn't written by Stieg Larsson.
So it's partly written by him, right?
I think it's based off his notes, isn't it?
So he started it.
Yeah.
It's not like the most recent one, which is completely made up.
Completely made up. I don't recall the...
Unlike, Stieg Larsson didn't
the
make his up.
Yes, which were documentaries. And I will remember the name of the author who's written this book. But this is based on The Girl in the Spider's Web.
It's like Lagercrantz or something.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern?
Yes, indeed. It's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. That is absolutely right. And this is directed by Fede Alvarez. David Lagercrantz. David Lagercrantz.
That's pretty close, I think. Lagercrantz, yeah. I mean...
It's not bad, is it? So this is the trailer, and it has Lisbeth Salander. And it says here, journalist Mikael Blomkvist, who of course is the co-lead of the three books and the film, played by Daniel Craig, of whom I can see little to no evidence in this trailer.
I mean, there were a couple of flashing images that could have been a man who was a journalist.
It could have been. Are those glasses? Is that a punch? Is that him?
But yes, it was certainly... They were definitely leading with their leading lady, let's say.
Yes.
But quite right, right?
Quite right. I mean, she looks great. And I think...
I don't know. I have to defend.
Okay.
Overweight, oversexed,
really?
Bespectacled. Okay. I have to defend overweight, bespectacled journalists here, okay?
Uh-huh.
Mikael Blomkvist is not as exciting or as sexy or as jazzy as Lisbeth Salander, but he was my anchor. He was my way into that world. And damn it, I need him in this trailer.
Okay, Chris. We'll get you the help you need.
Carry on.
I mean, I don't know the book. Do you know the book?
I haven't read this one, I'll be honest. No,
I don't know. I mean, is he in the book as much as he was in the previous ones? I don't know.
I don't know.
But we know he's in the film.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think this is probably a bit more Lisbeth than certainly the girl with the dragon tattoo, because she's become a more important character as the series went on.
Yes.
And more of the lead rather than co-lead. I think Foy looks great. I think it's really interesting what she's done since The Queen. And I think, you know, for someone who threatened to get kind of locked into that English period piece
Well, you know, she did breathe again straight afterwards.
Oh. She did breathe, which was what 1950s set. She did Wolf Hall. You know, she'd kind of come up that way, but since then she's done in Unsane and she's now done this, and it's just showing a completely different side of her, which I think is really exciting and really different, and shows that she's really trying to push the boundaries here and you know, do something different, which is great. I don't think anybody would have necessarily called her for this, you know, or called her as a likely candidate for this 2 or 3 years ago, and I think it's great that she's doing it. So yeah, excited to see her.
We'll definitely keep an eye on that one. Hashtag justice for Blomqvist. I'm just angry because I missed out on the role.
You were born to
Why
play
do you think I was working on this punch? Do you think this is because I enjoy sugary foods and not running and not having any exercise of any kind? No, I was...
We should go running somewhere.
I was stealth prepping for this role and they didn't even give me a shot.
That's really depressing. You should get a yum-yum to make up for it.
I should. So immediately after this, let's go get 2 mini cinnamon buns, which, of course, together are more healthy than 1 big cinnamon bun.
They've closed the Cinnabun on Piccadilly Circus.
Well, they've made a very powerful enemy on this day. Okay, so that's enough of the trailer talk. Let's talk now some very, very quick casting news. And I think we're all in a good mood after watching these incredible trailers. So it is time to ruin that good mood by saying that there is a Jared Leto Joker movie in the works.
Great.
Which obviously I'm all for.
Yeah, me
all
too.
For.
I have an official statement from me that I'd like to read at this time. It reads as follows.
I made a note in my diary on the way over here. It simply says, bugger. I mean, every day is Christmas Eve here on the Emperor Podcast, and I'm sure that this movie will turn out to be very, very good. But do we need another Joker movie? I mean, another Joker movie, given that there's one in the works with Todd Phillips and possibly Joaquin Phoenix. I don't know, but the interesting thing is that this announcement has come 2 years after Suicide Squad. And Suicide Squad, for all its many faults, was somehow a big hit around the world, made loads and loads of money, and some people, not anyone I know, but people who I've met and possibly walked past in the street seem to like it.
I quite like it.
Johnny quite likes it, but it's still taken him 2 years to do anything even close to resembling a sequel. You know, so there's the Harley Quinn Birds of Prey movie, which is in development. There's now this. We don't have a Suicide Squad 2. For example, Deadpool comes out in 2016. We've already got Deadpool 2. I'm surprised it's taken Warner Brothers and DC so long to get their act together in this. After this long of a wait, I'm surprised that what they've come up with is a Jared Leto Joker movie, when I would say
Killer Croc.
Killer Croc is the one.
Actually, Boomerang. I still wear my Boomerang t-shirt.
Well, there you go.
Boomerang was the best
really
thing in that.
Yeah, really
apart
Boomerang
from Harley Quinn, he was easily the best thing in that movie.
I thought Will Smith was fine in that movie.
Fine.
Had a bit of a
totally
movie
fine.
Star swagger to him.
Hey, we actually do quite like this movie.
Let's not go crazy.
I'm warming to it, actually, now, the more I think about it. A great soundtrack.
Here's the thing, right? And this is something we're going to get onto with reviews in a minute, right? But there's a phenomenon in Hollywood that any great villain, any truly great villain who sticks around for enough sequels becomes, if not the hero, at least the protagonist, right? And usually a hero or a goodie of some description. There are some characters for whom that fundamentally should not be true. It's the reason that the Hannibal prequel was entirely misconceived. It's a large part of the reason that the Star Wars prequels were entirely misconceived. There are some characters who are only meant to be villains and only work because they are great villains. And mm-hmm. the Joker is absolutely slap bang in the center of that group.
Yep.
He absolutely cannot be anything but an agent of chaos. He should not have anything resembling a canonical backstory.
Yep.
So there is probably a way of making him the focus of a film,
mm-hmm.
but it is a weird looking film. And if it is not a weird looking film, it's probably going to be terrible.
I mean, there are probably ways around it as well, but although I don't have as much of a problem with Leto's portrayal of the Joker, I think he was maybe hamstrung by the stories about his method approach to the movie and the things he was sending his co-stars and just a general Jared Leto apathy that I see online. And he was also hamstrung by the fact the movie he was in wasn't very good, but he wasn't horrendous. But I don't have any appetite to see it again.
Yeah.
But also, I think that this version of the Joker is very much a representation of and a hero of the nasty gentleman we were discussing at the beginning of the podcast in our question. The people who seem to think that it's okay to log on and harass people because they're agents of chaos and they don't give a shit and, you know, stick it to the man and all that nonsense. And I don't think we need a character that toxic to root for.
Trigger the libs.
Yes. Yeah, he would. He absolutely, the Joker would love to have a go at all those snowflakes. Other casting news, very, very quickly before we wrap up. We talked last week, Top Gun Maverick or Top Gun 2. I'm not entirely sure if the title has been confirmed. We were talking about the fact that Tom Cruise seems to be the only person in that film at the moment, which, again, I would be all for, but it is now confirmed that Val Kilmer will return as Iceman in that, which is great news.
He would be his wingman anytime. We have proof of it now.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's great, especially because, you know, I think it's been fairly well publicised that Val Kilmer's had some health issues in the last few years, and so it's great to see him bouncing back after that.
Absolutely.
And all the best to him. He's an awesome dude. And hopefully now we can get that Top Secret sequel that we've been begging for. I've been begging for.
I mean, it's just basically me and you.
Yeah.
Anybody else out there?
And my wife. She loves Top Secret.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
I know a little German. He's over there.
Isn't it weird that Val Kilmer was in Top Secret, which has a character called Deja Vu, and then he starred in Deja Vu?
Whoa.
Amazing. You have blown my mind.
Have we not met before?
But isn't it weird that Val Kilmer starred in a movie that had a character called Deja Vu, and then later starred in the movie Deja Vu?
Whoa.
You've blown my mind.
But isn't that amazing?
Two's
all
enough,
right, the last. No, three.
You've
three.
Blown
three.
My you mind.
No, Johnny, we've stopped. We've stopped. All right, last bit of casting news is that Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has drafted a batch of impressive acting talents, including Damian Lewis, fellow Red, Luke Perry, I assume he's a fellow Red, Emil Hirsch, and Dakota Fanning, Clifton Collins Jr., of whom I asked possibly the stupidest question in my career. Ever tell you this? Ever mention this in the podcast?
Have you ever played a mayor?
No, it wasn't have you ever played a mayor, and it wasn't the question I said to Sam Raimi once where I went, oh, the success of Evil Dead 2, that must have been beyond your wildest ken. And then I had to explain to him what that phrase meant, and I wasn't entirely sure what the phrase meant, and so neither of us really got it. Anyway, I was on set of Mindhunters a few years ago, which obviously remained the greatest set fits experience of my life, and it was a whole group of us brought in to a round table with Clifton Collins Jr., who was a lovely, lovely guy. And he comes in, and we're halfway through the interview, and then I suddenly, an epiphany hits me, something I've noted about the cast of this movie hits me, and I decided to unburden myself of this knowledge and ask him and see what he makes of this. And I go, isn't it weird? Isn't it weird that this movie has a whole bunch of people who've got three names in the cast? You know, Clifton Collins Jr., LL Cool J, Johnny Lee Miller, Val Kilmer. And I tried to make a joke of it at the end. I was really, you know. And Clifton Collins Jr. just looked at me with what I could only describe as utter disdain and decided not to answer the question. And I think that was pretty much the last question. And he walked out of the room. And then another film journalist, whose name I will withhold, it was Martin Palmer, leaned forward to me and went, Chris, mate, what the fuck was that? I just went, I don't know. I don't know. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. Because he was quite funny and I thought he would go for it. But sometimes you throw people an improv ball and sometimes that ball is made of lead and there's nothing they can do with it. I'm so sorry. So Clifton Collins Jr. is in it. Keith Jefferson and Nicholas Hammond. Hang on. Nicholas Hammond, who played Peter Parker in the Spider-Man TV series. Wow. You had my attention, now you have my curiosity. Or is it the other way around?
I don't know, but that line never made any sense.
It doesn't matter. So they've all signed on to star in this movie, which is, as we know, about a TV star, Rick Dalton, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and his stunt double Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt, who are trying to find a way in late 1960s Hollywood, and they live next door to Sharon Tate at the height of the Manson family mania. Sharon Tate, of course, played by Margot Robbie. So Damian Lewis is going to play Steve McQueen. which is
interesting.
Interesting. Dakota Fanning's going to play Squeaky Fromm, a Manson disciple who later tried to assassinate President Gerald Ford. Dick Samson's going to play Sam Wanamaker, who is the father and director as well, but also the father of Zoe Wanamaker.
Also founded the Globe.
Globe.
Yeah, the Globe Theatre.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes.
Shakespeare's Globe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He founded Shakespeare's Globe.
Yeah, well, like refounded it, you know.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Luke Perry's going to play Scotty Lancer. Clifton Collins Jr. is going to play Ernesto the Mexican Faquero. Keith Jefferson is Land Pirate Keith. And Emil Hirsch is Jay Sabring, who was one of the four victims in the...
Yes, the hairdresser. Murders.
The hairdresser, yes. Yeah. Burt Reynolds, Timothy Olyphant, Kurt Russell, Michael Madsen, Tim Roth, all on board. I'm very excited about this movie. I know we've talked about it in the past, and we're worried about how it's going to handle the Manson murders and the Sharon Tate murders.
Yeah.
But this cast is
It's a heck of a cast. There's no arguing with that cast list, no. My only equivocation, just as you were reading it out there, was sort of Brad Pitt playing Leonardo DiCaprio's stunt double. Like, I feel like that should be the other way around, but, you know, fine, I guess.
I think no. I think no, like Brad if you were, Pitt's more athletic and
yeah, but he's also like the
Leonardo.
Handsomer of the two.
Whoa!
No, this is correct. This is absolutely correct.
I don't.
Leonardo DiCaprio had a sort of youthful, weird-looking thing going on, but as he's grown older, everything that Leonardo DiCaprio was because of his youth, and now he's got nothing. Nothing.
that's a little further than I would have gone. But
no. In fact, I don't think I've gone far enough yet.
No. His face is just, it's an atrocity. His face is a hate crime.
No, okay, I just, as your lawyer, let's not go there. No, absolutely not.
You're right, sorry. I'd like to withdraw that remark about Leonardo DiCaprio. Sorry, I just thought of his face,
Look, DiCaprio is handsome. I'm not saying he isn't handsome, but he's not Brad Pitt handsome. Like, Shania Twain literally wrote a song about Brad Pitt handsome.
But only because Leonardo DiCaprio doesn't scan.
I just feel like she would have tried harder if he was that good looking.
So you're Leonardo DiCaprio. Doesn't fit. That don't impress me much. Brad Pitt fits. You see?
Yeah,
fits.
I'm just saying she wrote the song around it. You know,
yeah. Probably. But also Brad Pitt's older than Leonardo DiCaprio. So stunt doubles can sometimes be older than the actor that doubling for. So that kind of makes sense.
Sure.
But wow, you dropped a bombshell there. I think that's it for our epic news section. Okay, as you know, this week's podcast is sponsored by Sky Cinema, which gives you unlimited access to the best movies at home, whenever and wherever you want, in the best possible way. I have been a Sky Cinema subscriber for many years now. I love the choice they offer. They have over 1,000 quality movies on demand, ready for me to enjoy whenever I want. My first recommendation is one of the best horror movies in years and one of the best Stephen King films in well over a decade for me. It is, of course, an adaptation of King's massive 1,000-plus page novel, which sees a group of people battle an evil clown named Pennywise in the fictional town of Derry, Maine. This adaptation by Andy Muschietti, who directed Mama, splits the book cleverly into two parts, and this part focuses on the group as kids coming together to fight Pennywise in the 1980s after he kills a young boy in the terrifying prologue. It captures a novel sense of deft characterization. It has some wonderfully scary scenes, and it is an absolute belter. I cannot wait for the sequel, which begins filming this year. You can familiarize yourself right now by watching it on Sky Cinema. Then my next recommendation is actually three recommendations. Ocean's 8 opens this month, and it's a reboot of / sequel to Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's trilogy, which saw an all-star cast get together to pull off three very daring, very different heists. Slick, stylish, often subversive. I have a lot of time for these movies. Even the often maligned Ocean's 12, which I think is one of the truly daring sequels. It does things that most sequels don't even begin to attempt. All three films are endlessly rewatchable, very, very quotable, and it's a blast to watch the likes of George Clooney, Julia Roberts, Matt Damon, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Brad Pitt, Don Cheadle, Andy Garcia, Al Pacino, Casey Affleck, all those guys just be the coolest mothers on the planet. So those are my recommendations this week on Sky Cinema. Join me next week for more Sky Cinema-related fun. Time now for this week's guest. He is... I don't know, I say this every single time, but he is one of our favourite actors and one of my favourite actor people in my time doing this job. He is a lovely, lovely chap and one of the most successful actors of all time. If you look at his career, he has been, of course, in the Lord of the Rings movies. He has been in the Hobbit movies. He has been in the Star Wars movies. He has been in the Planet of the Apes trilogy. And of course, the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well, with appearances in Avengers Age of Ultron and Black Panther. Does that make Andy Serkis pound for pound the most lucrative, the most successful actor in the history of movies? It could well be. Black Panther, of course, is out on DVD and Blu-ray this Monday, June 11th. Fantastic film. If you haven't seen it, it is an absolute cracker. And if you haven't listened to our spoiler special with the film's co-writer and director Ryan Coogler and the executive producer Nate Moore, go and check out that one right now. Andy Serkis in that movie, of course, plays Ulysses Claw. And when Black Panther was just about to come out back in February, I went along and spoke to him about that movie and about a great many other things besides. Had a lot of fun with this one, and I hope you guys do too. He is awesome. Enjoy. Hey everyone, it's Chris here, recording this in my flat the day after we recorded the main podcast, because I listened back to the Andy Serkis podcast and I realized I should give you guys a heads up that this is really, really spoilerific. It's one of the benefits or drawbacks, depending on your point of view, of doing this, knowing that we were going to hold it for the DVD. So it is very spoilerific, not just about Black Panther, but also about Andy Serkis' roles in Star Wars The Last Jedi and War for the Planet of the Apes as well. So if you haven't seen any of those films, maybe skip right to the very end where we talk about Mowgli. Otherwise, enjoy this interview where we talk about Black Panther, War for the Planet of the Apes, and The Last Jedi. Okay, Chris out. Bye. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast once again. He won't stop appearing on the Empire Podcast. We try and put up barricades outside the door, but he keeps getting in. Andy Serkis, how are you, sir?
I'm very, very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Good, good, good. We are recording this. People are hearing this at the time of the DVD release,
right,
of Black Panther, but we're recording it as the film's about to come out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Last night, the premiere, the European premiere, took place, and I rarely felt an atmosphere in a screening like last night's. There seems to be an incredible bubble of excitement around this movie.
Joe, it's extraordinary. I don't think I've ever been in a film that has been anticipated as much. And I mean, people coming up every day for the last, you know, during the course of this last year.
Wow.
Saying, when's Black Panther coming out? When's Black Panther coming out? I mean, I don't think I was ever prepared for that or had any idea that it would. I just don't know why it wasn't on my radar. But clearly, it's been this hugely wanted movie. I mean, yeah. It's just like, it's the time is now, is there's been the feel of it, you know.
And yeah.
You know, both, like you say, last night at the London premiere, but also in the LA premiere, that the crowds just went berserk. You know, it was like this huge release. It was like a big release of energy. And the whole kind of outreach that this film has had, you know, the charities that are, you know, buying tickets for people to go and, for young kids to go and see them, you know, in Harlem, for instance, or for, you know, across the states. I'm seeing this as, I mean, it's hard to picture, isn't it? But if you imagine being a child, a black child now, or person of, you know, an ethnic minority, or you know, watching this film, your first superhero movie, and it's this, then this is your normality. And from now on, this will be the normality. And so the kind of the sea change is pretty massive.
This is it.
You know, not that there haven't been brilliantly made black movies before, or there haven't been black lead characters before, but in a tentpole movie of this scale that is reached by billions across the planet, this is a landmark. You know,
obviously, Claw is introduced in Age of Ultron. Ross is introduced in Civil War, as is T'Challa. But otherwise, you could go into this movie completely blind. You don't have to have seen Age of Ultron to get your backstory.
No,
to get Claw's backstory.
No, absolutely not. And that's what I love about it, because there is a sort of you know, in the world of binge watching, this sort of terrible, if you haven't watched them or you don't know them, any TV series or film franchise, if you can feel excluded. You can feel like, oh no, well, I've got, how long is it going to take me to catch up and get me up to speed with where all these characters are? And it really doesn't matter with this one. It's genuinely, you can, as you say, walk into it, and it's like a fresh palette.
You know? And it doesn't set up the other movies. It doesn't take a detour to suddenly go, and now we have the sixth Infinity Stone. And that's fine. I like that. I'm a huge Marvel fan, and I love when they do that. But I thought this was really interesting. I spoke to Ryan Coogler the other day about how self-contained it was and whether there was pressure on them to incorporate other references. But he said no. He said he had the utter freedom to make this movie. And it's a movie that I can't help but feel doesn't get made 10 years ago. Mm. Maybe gets made 5 years ago, mm-hmm. but it's very, very different if it gets made 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. The fact that this movie embraces its Africanness, if that's a word, was extraordinary to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, it's sort of the majority of the film is centered around that world, and it's so smart that it sort of bucks expectation as well. It's that this outer covering and what Ulysses Claw would see is a hypocrisy, because he thinks they're trading on this notion that the rest of the world thinks they're poor, and yet they're sitting on the greatest mineral resource ever known to man, and so that's what that was my approach into the character, is that. Because of course, when you're playing the dark end of the spectrum as a villain, you have to find a morally justifiable way of operating, because that's what you do as an actor.
Yeah,
and so I think him trying to sort of unpicking this hypocrisy made me feel like I'm doing the right thing, which is of course what you have to do.
That's interesting, because I've talked to a lot of actors over the years, as you know, and a lot of actors say of playing a bad guy, he's not bad. He's, you have to see it from his point of view. But come on, Andy. Ulysses Claw is a bad man. I mean, surely he must know that what he's doing. He's doing it for shits and giggles, and he has a big smile on his face all the way through.
He's
loving it.
Yeah, I mean, look, yes, he is. He's unhinged, but his mother loves him. And,
I want to meet his mum now. Yeah. What sort of mother loves that son?
Well, she's listened to his mixtapes, and she... So, and actually, I'm going to assemble a Ulysses Claw mixtape, by the way, so I'll probably come back to you on that.
Please do. Give me the SoundCloud link.
Okay, I will do. So, I think it's important, that especially kind of how he functions in this particular story. He is an agent of chaos, and he's an arms dealer. He's a gangster. He's he works with governments, and in order to be able to do that, you have to feel like you could spend an evening with him, sitting in a bar, sitting in a cafe, or doing a meeting, and actually being seduced by him in some way. So I wanted to make that play, really, that you could sort of enjoy him and then think, oh my god, what am I doing, and that he could turn at any given point.
He's like a Marvel version of Frank Booth and Blue Velvet.
Right, exactly.
in a weird way.
Exactly.
But he looks like a character you had enormous fun playing.
No, not at all. No, it was really it was really strained and difficult. No,
it was a horrible technical exercise.
Horrible, and working with Martin Freeman again. Ugh.
That bloody guy.
God. Not Bilbo again. Oh, no. It was brilliant.
Here's another riddle. Yeah, here we go.
I know, that was the other thing. I didn't actually know when... I didn't see Civil War. So when I found out that Martin was playing Ross...
It's a good film.
I was completely shocked. And then when I read the script, it was less like, oh, my God, we've got the scenes together. And it really made me... So when I turned up, and Martin had been there a little time before I actually turned up on set. It was just joyful seeing him again, and just really good fun. And we had a ball. We actually had a ball doing it together, and because I caught all my stuff with him, obviously. And then Ryan just really, he really does keep you in the moment, and he's such a great director. He created such a great vibe on set. It was fun. It was cool. It was just like we're really gonna really mine these moments and try different things, and he just gave us freedom to explore and have fun.
So there seems, from my eyes, there's a fair amount of improv in this movie. I imagine you singing Baby Don't Hurt Me.
Yeah, that wasn't scripted. That was sort of, it came out of me sort of, doing some sort of funky beats and sort of making these... And singing other songs, actually. And then this is the one that he stuck with, And then Martin finding... barely being able to contain himself coming through the door. He said he really struggled, actually. And there is that deliciousness, actually, of being on the edge of hysteria. At times that can be really great as an actor, you know, when yes. you're in character and you're vibing off the other actor, and then but there are these moments where, because you know that person, that you yes. sail very close to kind of losing it in a way, and you're totally present, and it is a wonderful.
What did you know about Black Panther when you signed on to do Age of Ultron? Did you?
Well, obviously, I had to start looking at the context of the character in Black Panther, because that's where he comes about. You know,
so you were told about this movie when you signed on for Age of Ultron.
I looked at the Black Panther comics okay. for Age of Ultron.
Sure,
and so I didn't know that. I thought, well, look, if there ever is a Black Panther, that it would be likely that Claw would appear, because he's, you know, one of the major adversaries yep. for him. So, so I thought, but then of course the comic version of Claw is. I'm glad we didn't go that way, quite frankly. I've had enough of Lycra. And, you know, wearing a pink leotard, you know, and with a megaphone on the end of your arm, not particularly a good look, I thought. So
I don't know. I think you could pull it off. You've done weirder, let's put it that way.
Well, yes, but pink, I don't know. You know, but yes, so I thought, but anyway, I mean, because of course Claw, when he's, you know, he is of a South African descent, he mm-hmm. is a Boer yes. character, he's, you know, would have been around at the time of sort of during the apartheid time, so his attitude towards people of colour would have been pretty brutal. And the way that he refers to Killmonger is pretty patronising. He calls him boy.
Yep.
You know, he's used to the old regime in South Africa.
He still calls Wakandans savages,
exactly.
despite everything he knows about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he's a big old racist.
Yeah, he totally is.
And he gets what's coming to him. And that's one of the spoilerific things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
At what point did you know that you were not going to make it out? That you were, as far as we know, you were done with the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, I know, and it's not been a good year, I can tell you.
I've watched you die on the big screen now.
This is my third time in 6 months. It's not good.
It's not.
I've chewed up all my franchises.
You've got to start again.
I know. Where am I going to go next? It was shocking, but it was you know, again, it comes at exactly the right point in the story, so that the handover then goes to Killmonger and it's a good. He is really actually an amazingly big red herring, actually.
Yeah.
So you don't realise that until that point. I mean, look, I was very sad to see him go, because I did love the character and I'd love to have done more with him. But no, I can see totally why it needs to be that way, because again, in service of what this film is and where the message of the film really lies, and the brilliant performance of Michael Jordan's character as Killmonger, who becomes the real nemesis. But then, of course, what you realise about his character is that you almost understand his worldview, and emotionally, you really do. You suffer with him at the end, as
he's been deeply wronged.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really interesting. I mean, you know, very often is these movies about stark contrasts, good, evil,
yeah.
completely defined in that way.
Absolutely. And that is one of the strengths of this movie. It's very nuanced. Every single character, I think, you feel is a three-dimensional character, even as someone as out there as Ulysses Claw, hopefully. you know, you feel like they are real, and that they exist as people, and that they're not cartoon characters.
We spoke, I think the last time we spoke on the podcast was for War for the Planet of the Apes. And we talked then about your final scenes as Caesar and how they were really emotional for you to film.
Yeah.
Obviously you had an incredible attachment to that character. When you're filming Claw's final scenes or Snoke's final scenes, for example, in The Last Jedi, what was that experience like for you? Is it similarly emotional? Are you as attuned to those characters, having played them less often? I guess
it's, they're both in these cases sort of shock moments, really. So with Caesar, there is, I think this is, you know, it was having played him through his entire life, from, you know, from birth to from infancy through to, you know, through the whole long life that I spent and time that I spent with that character, there was but also a sense of how Caesar leaves the world, which is I've brought my people to where I think they're going to be safe. So there is a real sense of letting go, and so there is that. There's a sort of inner joy and an acceptance, a peace as he slips away, actually. and feels that they'll be in good shape and in good hands. And so as he sees his son from a distance, there is sadness, but it's you know, it is letting go at the right time. Whereas with these characters, you know, with Snoke, it's very much a shock moment, so he doesn't have a lot of time to think about it. and yes, it is a loss, but with Claw, you know, again, he is one of those characters who is, I keep thinking of him as he is this agent of chaos, you know, yeah. and in a way, he doesn't even put up resistance when he sees that Killmonger has the Wakanda tattoo on the inside of his lip.
Yeah.
He knows he's done for. And it's sort of, it reminds me of that moment in Goodfellas, actually, where Joe Pesci walks into the bar.
Yeah.
And he just goes, oh, God, you know, it's, oh, no. You know, it's just like, oh, I didn't see that one coming. Boff, you know. Yeah. And,
It must be interesting going through his head. I don't know what you thought, what your preparations were for that moment, but this is a man who's gone toe-to-toe with the Avengers, you know, faced off with Ultron.
Yeah.
And this guy?
Yeah, exactly.
This guy is the one who's going to kill me?
Yeah, exactly. No, I know. It's just like, what? You know, it's really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and I wanted his death to feel, I did want his death to feel real and you know, that he... It happened so quickly. The turnaround happened so quickly, and it is a shock. I think it's a shock for the audience too.
Yeah.
I know my boys were very shocked when they saw it last night. They both turned to me and were like, "Oh,
not another one."
You know? It really was. They all literally in sync turned around and were kind of like, made it to the end of another movie.
Yeah, have to get cracking in those new franchise scripts. That's for sure. That's for sure. And with reference to Snoke, when did you know?
Oh, I knew, but you know, look, here's the deal. As I think I may have said to you before, but we only had very little time to read these scripts because you only got to read it like once. In whole form, or I did anyway.
Wow. Okay,
and it was on a tablet, so you can't take it away with you. Excuse me, and then you get these kind of electronic readers, which are like big Kindles, basically.
Yeah,
and so I find it very hard to learn lines off these things actually. But anyway, you'd get them for that day, and then it would just be your scene on it, and it's so. But anyway, I read it for the first time. And I was like, oh, this is a great scene. Oh, my gosh, where's this going? Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God. Oh, okay. Oh, dear. All right. It was a bit of a shock. But again, it was so – it's beautifully woven in, and I love what Rian Johnson did with that too, you know, and it's a great scene in the film, I think. It's, you know, it pissed a lot of people off because it's just like, well, who is he? Who is it? You know, but and I keep putting out. Well, look, in the Snoke spin-off, I keep saying because it is Star Wars, and who knows? I think if I say it enough, it'll become a reality.
Well, this is true. You know how William Shatner writes Star Trek novels?
I didn't know that.
He does. Yeah, he writes Star Trek novels, or used to. I mean, he's written a couple, that's for sure. And I think you could write your very own Snoke book.
That is. Not a bad idea, actually.
There you
go. That is a very, very good idea. And I'll put it on sale when the mixtape comes out.
But there does seem to be, I mean, this is very much a closing of a chapter in your life of doing all these massive franchises back to back.
I'm going to cry in a minute.
I'm sure you're fine. I'm sure it's all good. But is that a deliberate thing, or is it just completely coincidental? Are you looking to focus more on directing going forward?
It's certainly not intentional. Nothing to do with me. It's just the way it's gone.
It's other people choosing to kill you off.
Absolutely. What have these people got against me? You know. Yes.
Because you're notoriously difficult to work with. That's why.
Yeah, I think they go, oh, get him out. Get him off my set now. Look, directing, yes. I mean, Mowgli is finally coming out this year after a long period of time.
Fantastic.
But I'm super excited about it. I really love it, and I love the way it's shaping up. We're 3 months away from completion.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
We'll start to see some stuff, materials going to start to hit the internet and trailers and all the rest of it, which I'm very excited about this coming out. Who knows how it'll be accepted? You just don't know. It is, as we've discussed before, it is a much darker telling of the tale. And yep. A tale about identity and otherness and, not belonging to the world of animal or man and having to basically create, Mowgli creating his own version of himself, really. Mm. But the animal performances and Rohan Chand, who plays Mowgli, is extraordinary, I think. He's a gifted child. He really, really is. He's given the most amazing performance. And then the animals are just, they are very emotionally connective and real and, they represent different aspects of Mowgli's journey and his tutorage and being brought into the world. I think it's... I just hope that it's all going to be about the messaging of the film, to get it out there to people so that they feel that they are ready for another essentially Jungle Book story, but this one is so different. It really is different.
Visually
and tonally,
So when you say things like the animals feel real, are you going for photorealism or is it more exaggerated?
They are photoreal. You will believe that they are a bear, a panther, but creating license for them to talk so that you will see the actors' faces in those performances. So the design of the animals was crucial when we created them. We wanted them to obviously be the animal that they are. But if you imagine putting a panther at one end of the spectrum and then Christian Bale's face at the other, and then the designer morphed basically Christian Bale's face and a panther's, and then if you go along the line, at some point there's a sweet spot where you absolutely see both. That's the approach that we took, because talking animals are notoriously difficult to pull off. It's one thing to take the physiognomy of an actor and turn my face into Caesar's. An ape's face is relatively similar, humanoid in shape, but to get to the skull and musculature of a wolf or a snake or a panther or a bear, and yet to be able to really read emotionally what those characters are thinking and feeling, the retargeting on those characters is enormous. So I'm really glad we have had the time to actually really develop that, and I'm feeling now it's coming together. It does work.
Fantastic. But was it at first a source of frustration that there was a delay, that the film was pushed back, or at the same time is that a blessing in disguise, because it gives you A, the time to get it right, and B, it moves you away from Jungle Book, so you have that gap. You have that.
I mean, it is now. I mean, at the beginning, the fact of the matter is our one was pretty much announced
beforehand,
the Disney one, and then it became a race, and then it became, there's no point in having a race, we need to take our time to get this right. And then I was able to go off and shoot, after we'd shot our version, I was able to go off and shoot Breathe in post-production. So wow. And do Star Wars and do Black Panther. And meanwhile, I was able to still keep working. Because when I was on set doing the Black Panther, when I wasn't on set, I was in a room in Atlanta talking to everybody back in Framestore in London and an editorial in London working on Mowgli. So it was a kind of a crazy time, but it's all coming to closure now. I'm looking forward to the next now.
Andy, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you
so much.
Take
Fantastic.
Care. Cheers, buddy.
Okay, so that was Andy Serkis, and he is the mocap king. And so I was a little bit surprised to find that he wasn't playing a dinosaur in this week's big release, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, because I thought that would have been just the sort of thing he would turn up on his day off, don the mocap onesie, and play a raptor. But nope, doesn't seem to have done that.
That we know of,
precisely. So Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is the big release this week. It is the fifth movie in the Jurassic Park franchise, the second movie in this new trilogy, and the sequel to the mega successful Jurassic World, which came out a few years ago, and propelled by the box office power of Nick Desemlian, as Edmund made $1.6 billion around the world. Now, the director Colin Trevorrow has stepped aside to take producing and writing duties in this. He's replaced in the director's chair by J.A. Bayona, director of Monster Calls and The Orphanage and The Impossible. And what has he cooked up for us, Helen?
Well, he's cooked up a little bit of a spin on the formula. So we're basically brought back to the island, Isla Nublar, because there is a volcano. Its formerly dormant peak has become undormant and is threatening to erupt, basically threatening to kill all dinosaurs on the island. Claire, Bryce Dallas Howard's character, has rather improbably become a dinosaur rights activist. You would think that nearly being eaten by one might give her a pause, but no, she's still on the side of the lizards. And so she's trying to campaign for them to be resettled somewhere for some kind of rescue mission. Her efforts seem in vain until James Cromwell's, is it Lockwood, calls her in and says, I am an independently wealthy man. I used to work with Hammond and I'm going to help you out.
He never mentioned me before.
But I was definitely there. I was.
Look, I've got his cane.
He actually did. So that was nice.
Yeah, I wasn't just making this shit up.
No, it was all put together. She goes and recruits Owen, which is Chris Pratt's character name, which I think we all remember really well.
Owen Grady.
Look at that. You were reminded in the last week, guys. It's not that impressive.
I know Owen Grady.
I believe you.
I know him.
Owen Grady.
Good Lord. Anyway, so she does this at the behest of Race Bull, who is Baddy McBadson, I believe is his character name.
But not yet. We think he's good. We think he's good at this point.
We do for a minute, but like a minute. He wears a waistcoat, for God's sake, with a jacket. And he is kind of Lockwood's majordomo, and he basically sets Claire off on this mission. But it soon becomes clear that he's planning to steal the dinosaurs for himself and sell them to the highest bidder.
What a fucker.
What a bastard.
It soon becomes clear because we've seen the trailer, which shows us all of this.
Which shows us all of this, yes. And this all happens basically in a big old country house. So it's an interesting spin on the Jurassic Park/World/formula, because suddenly it's almost like a weirdly gothic haunted house movie while also being a Jurassic Park movie, which is an interesting combination. Mm-hmm. There is, of course, an adorable Moppet who is threatened by the whole thing, and she has to be rescued by Owen and Claire.
Cool.
We hope. Or maybe she'll be eaten by a dinosaur. I don't want to give anything away. She might be.
Is it scary?
You know what? I was scared. I think this is one of the scarier Jurassic films, let's say, at this point. And I think there's some interesting ideas about which Jeff Goldblum gets in his all too brief appearance in front of a Senate committee, where he's basically explaining, you know, this genetic power to create life cannot be put back in the box. Life, if you will, finds a way.
Finds a way.
And that's essentially what's going on here. So we're seeing kind of dinosaurs get out of the control of one corporation and kind of maybe be spread more widely, potentially.
Very exciting. Bayona is a very, very good director. I've liked all three of his previous movies. What does he bring to this? Does he handle it well? He's quite a Spielberg disciple. Does it feel like a bit of a Spielbergian?
I mean, there are so many nods to the Spielberg movies. There's a set piece in one, is it called a gyroscope? Those big balls that they...
Gyroscope, yeah.
So which is very similar to the trailers in The Lost World where the glass is cracking. There's a similar action scene there. There's lovely visual nods to it throughout where... Do you remember in the first one where she's trying to pull that thing down in the kitchen and the raptor's running towards her? There's a similar scene with a dumbwaiter in the old country house. So he's got those nods to Spielberg's films all the way through.
Yeah, he does.
And of course, I mean, he did The Orphanage, which, and the haunted house, it's not haunted, it's dinosaur-ridden house. The big country house at the end, that's all very similar and, you know, gothic scares and shadows and everything everywhere. Mm.
There's some cool new dinosaurs and some less cool dinosaur decisions, I thought.
Okay.
So on one hand, you know, I think the T-Rex is still great and is still used in a very Spielbergian way. There's a, what is it, Pachycephalosaurus or something? The dinosaur with a really hard head. Yeah. Who is brilliant and instantly became my favourite. I wasn't so keen on the new bad dinosaur who's kind of following in the footsteps of the Indominus Rex.
Yes. So this is the Indoraptor. Which is, I mean, they make a point of how he is like slightly crazy. So he's got like ticks and like goes and then like gets the shakes.
Okay.
He's a crazy dinosaur.
She's
a crazy dinosaur.
So that was, I mean, creepy, but not maybe as good as some kind of baddie dinosaurs we've had before, if you will. And my big problem with the film, if I'm honest, is the velociraptors. And I feel like velociraptors last time got a bit of a do-over, so they suddenly became not the big bad, but... Well. Or little bad.
What were you saying about the Joker?
Exactly. This is exactly what prompted it. They got a bit of a makeover last time, but this has gone even further towards velociraptors are our friends, really. And I'm not there for it.
They'll have your face off.
They would have your face off. And this is what annoys me. Like, they can't be the good guys. Like, the T-Rex has always been sort of the good guy in these films, but only in the sense that if he didn't notice you, you were fine. And he was too big to notice you most of the time. He always had somebody else he wanted to... You're right. She always had somebody else that she wanted to kill more than you. That's why she would accidentally save you.
Gennaro.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, this has literal velociraptors acting altruistically, and I just have a problem with that.
So the last movie, I was going to say the first movie. The first movie is, of course, one of the greatest movies ever made. Yeah. The last movie, Jurassic World... It's a sort of film that if it's even mentioned on Twitter will get an absolute kicking. There will be people will log on, people will get notifications saying, oh, they're talking about Jurassic World on Twitter, I must pile on. And they just log on to Twitter just to go, it's shit, and then they run away again. And even at the time, it was quite divisive. And people genuinely, like Kat Brown, our friend Kat Brown, thinks it's one of the worst sequels ever made, if not the worst sequel ever made. I have never understood that. I've always thought Jurassic World, it's not a great movie, but it's, for me, the best Jurassic Park sequel and does a lot of things right. Does a lot of things wrong, obviously, the whole Claire running in heels business.
Yeah,
you know,
which they make a joke of here. I was a bit mixed on the last one. I have to say, I was in the Lake District recently and turned on TV and thought that Jurassic Park was on. I was like, ooh, and then the you know, it took a second for the picture to come up and it was actually Jurassic World and I'd misread it. And there was a real moment of, ugh.
So, really?
Yeah,
I don't understand that at all. I mean, I think it's...
I mean, it was fine, but I watched it, obviously. Right, like, okay. I'm not a monster, but, you know, it's a real climb down. And I would put The Lost World... If I were ranking the Jurassic films, I'd put The Lost World.
Oh, should we
well
do a really quick ranking? Go.
Really quick mini episode of the ranking. Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the ranking.
Is this an episode of... I love the ranking.
I love the ranking, yes.
This is probably actually, for me, it's 1, 2, 3, 5, 4.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I'd go 1, 4, 3, 2. But with the caveat that I have not yet seen 5, I'm going to see it this weekend.
I would say 1, 4, 2, 3, 5.
Ooh.
Thanks.
Well, there we go. Oh, wow. They weren't that fairy, those lists, but so many fine films, but okay. So there you go, that was the episode of the ranking. So what did we make of this film overall? We gave it, as a magazine, as an entity, 4 stars. So I'm very excited to see how it comes out. Are we happy with that? Yeah, are we good with that? Yeah.
I can see it. I'm probably slightly leaning more towards a 3 personally, but I'm not far off. I enjoyed lots of it, and I was
scared. It divided
scared.
The office, I think.
Yeah. I was
there
scared.
Were moments that were scary, which, and I don't think it's been properly scary since the first one. Which is basically a horror.
At times, yeah.
We've had that argument before. What does it do wrong? Because again, I've seen people being divided on Twitter. I've seen people go, it's a lot of fun, it's more fun than the last one. And I've seen other people like David Ehrlich go, this is a dreadful, dreadful film, run as far as fast.
I think the character work is poor.
Okay.
Generally speaking, I still find both leads quite annoying. And I like both actors in other things.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's them.
Okay.
I found the supporting characters... There is one character who is there as comic relief who I did not find funny in the slightest.
Is that Justice Smith?
I was trying to be frankly. Nice. And.
But the thing is, I love him as an actor. Like, I find him so hugely empathetic in, like, The Rundown, in Paper Towns. I just want the best for him. And I just want to protect him from all the world. I think he's so wonderful in them.
Yeah.
And I agree that he did not make an impact here. And I feel like that's the film failing its actors rather than the actors failing.
Oh, absolutely,
film,
yeah. Because you know? it can't just be him, because I think the comedy falls flat quite
across
a lot in the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Blimey.
So,
four stars. Yeah.
But I mean, but like I said, there are great dinosaur moments and really scary scares.
Yeah, 4 stars for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And the other film of note this week, full disclosure, none of us have yet seen it, but we're very excited to see it, and it is McQueen, which is a documentary about the late fashion designer Alexander McQueen.
Lee McQueen is his real name, and Alexander is his middle name, which is he used because it was posher. Hmm. And so it's a documentary in almost two parts. It's his rise to fame in the 90s and all the crazy stuff that was going on there. Lots of footage from his shows, which were really visually arresting. And then obviously we then moved to the sadder end of his life and career, as which, you know, because at the end he obviously committed suicide. Hmm. But it's, by all accounts, a tremendous documentary. Really good on the 90s stuff, mm-hmm. and, you know, really, well, emotional and sad by the end.
Yeah, and I guess brought into sharp relief and made perhaps even more relevant in a strange way by the tragic death this week of Kate Spade.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it just goes to show how success and apparently a wonderful life is no protection against the awful disease that is depression. And, yeah. Lots of love to her family and friends this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have to say, I was always a McQueen skeptic, and then I went to the exhibition that the V&A did on him a couple of years ago, and it was phenomenal. Absolutely incredible work. So I am very much going to see this weekend, and I'm sorry I have not seen it already.
Indeed. Likewise. I haven't seen a lot recently. The old day job has been getting in the way, but I know that people think my day job is to watch films. It isn't always.
It's to edit podcasts.
It's to edit a podcast. That's largely what it's becoming. But I do really want to see this film as well. And we gave it
four stars.
Yeah. 4 stars in for McQueen also. And by the way, I should say as well, our Jurassic World spoiler special with Colin Trefaro and Juan Antonio Bayona will be up on June 26th. So we're holding it back until after the US release. And so there, that's it. That's all I wanted to say. Just wanted to let you know that's what's happening. Because that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by Sky Cinema. Join us next week for more film-related fun. Well, we'll be joined by the great Alfred Molina.
Oh.
Ooh.
Very excited about that. He is in town doing a new, well, not new play, but a new version of the play Red.
I have an out-of-date fact about him.
Go on then.
He was, at one point, he was the person with the most Lego minifigures of his characters.
I know that. I interviewed him around that time.
Yeah, because he had the Indiana Jones one, he had the Spider-Man one, and he had one other, which would have been...
Prince of Persia.
There we go, Prince of Persia. Can you imagine such a thing?
I also have a fact about him. When I went to do that interview with him, he did this massive double take when I walked into the room and then looked at me really weirdly. And
he
then
thought you were Harrison Ford.
He told me that apparently I am really uncannily like a girl he used to date in college and almost married.
Oh, I use that line all the time.
Well, I'm just saying.
Chris, actually, I was about to say to you.
Yeah?
You look uncannily like a girl I used to date.
I have a fact about Alfred Molina.
What's yours?
He has the power of the sun in the palm of his hand.
I know that.
There we go. And we may also be joined by a mystery guest. So, exciting. What could it be? Who could it be?
Is it James Dyer?
It's not James Dyer. We've locked the doors. We've barricaded the doors, made sure he can't just waltz in halfway through a podcast like he tends to do. But until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Johnny Pyle.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hey, wait, is this an episode of It's Goodbye from Johnny Pyle?
I think it might be.
Hey, everyone, this is Chris Hewitt.
And this is Johnny Pyle.
And we're saying goodbye from Johnny Pyle.
Goodbye, everyone.
Good ep. Great ep.
Great okay. ep. Great.
It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodle pip.
And it's goodbye from me. And it's goodbye from me. I am off to watch Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom at some point this week. I'm very excited because I hear it has more dinosaurs in it than the Tory Party Conference. Boom. Bit of political satire for you there just to end the podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Other political parties are available. Bye.